Today's show is brought to you by Of A Kind, an online shop for emerging design. For more information, visit ofakind.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
Live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to Word of Mouth with Leti Su on heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Leti Su. And what do I do when I'm not hosting Word of Mouth? Out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear here, and working with my clients, which include chefs, sommeliers, big brands and startups, all those doing what's most innovative and delicious. We are sticking around in Brooklyn today with our fabulous lineup, starting off with John Poyarkoff, executive chef at the Pines in Gowanus. It's my first time to Grand Army Plaza Green Market, and my first time in a really, really, really long time going to any green market in this winter wonderland that we are encountering. We're going to go pick up some parsnips. And then here in the studio, we'll have live Daniel Burns, chef owner of Luxus at Taurus in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. This guy's worked at the Fat Duck and St. John in London and at Noma Restaurant in Copenhagen. And he came back to New York City to help start the Momofuku Research and Development Lab. He was recently named one of Adam Platt's top five best new chefs 2014. And we're going to talk Mom Kedrigi. Can't really say that correctly, Kedrigi, and what it means to be a Canadian guy cooking food that everyone's calling Scandinavian. Then, stay to the end, because to wind down, we're going to catch up with Colin Tuska, wine director at Prospect Restaurant in Fort Greene, with whom I play devil's advocate. Do we really care that much about grapes that are almost going extinct? And now, let's head to the green market. I'm at the Grand Army Plaza Green Market with John Poyarkoff. He is the executive chef at the Pines in Gowanus, Brooklyn. And he was last at the Modern as a sous chef. Hello.
Hey.
Thanks for joining me on this beautiful day. It feels like spring.
Yeah, it's a nice day to go to the market.
Finally.
Finally.
So, I will admit that I have not been to the market in the last, say, 4 to 5 weeks, disappointing all of our word-of-mouth listeners.
And the last time I was here, there was about 6 inches of snow, and it was coming down hard as soon as I got here. And we were at Phillips Farm, and there was one guy whose only job was to stand on a ladder and brush off the tent so it didn't collapse on everyone. Brushing off snow from vegetables before you pick them up. It's fun.
I wonder what the Craigslist listing for that job was like. So, what is catching your eye today?
Well, obviously this is a weird time for produce because winter stuff is ending. A lot of it's been frozen in the ground for a while. Spring stuff isn't quite here yet. But what's awesome right now is sweeter root vegetables. And today I'm picking up some parsnips. We're doing a lot of fun stuff at the restaurant with what's available right now. So we give everyone an amuse when they come in. And for the winter, we've been doing a little bite of a warm soup. So these parsnips from Phillips Farm are super sweet, super delicious, concentrated parsnip flavor. They're in the frozen ground. They're struggling to survive, which makes them a lot more flavorful. So we roast them until they're super concentrated, peel them and whip them. We're actually doing a vegan whipped soup with them. Parsnips and a little bit of turnip. The bitterness of the turnip kind of counteracts the super sweetness of the parsnip. Then we whip that. We're covering it with a little black onion powder and vanilla salt. You're always taught, like, in culinary school, classic French cuisine, the only thing you're allowed to burn is an onion because they still taste delicious. So we take onions and we have a wood-burning grill in our backyard. We just put them on over wood and let them burn, basically, for hours and hours and hours until it's like a little piece of onion charcoal. And then we throw that in the dehydrator to make sure it's super dry, then grind it up in a mortar and pestle into a powder. It just adds this, like, kind of smoky umami flavor. It still tastes like onion. It doesn't actually taste burnt. It just tastes like a crazy umami bomb onion.
How are you picking the perfect parsnip? What are we looking for?
Well, for the restaurant, larger is better, but not the most important factor. You want to feel it. You want to make sure it feels heavy for its weight. That means it's not that dried out. Mm-hmm. Like this one's kind of flimsy. That means it's kind of past its prime. It's going to be kind of fibrous and not as tender in the middle, not as moist and juicy.
Tell me about Phillips Farms.
Based on their advice.
They're from Milford, New Jersey. It's a gigantic farm. They have a lot of great seasonal produce. The carrots are phenomenal. Root vegetables, apples. They have some great wine sap apples. Leafy greens in the summer are killer. They're at almost every market, and they're just a good standby. They don't always have the most interesting, unique stuff, but they always have great produce. You know you're getting good quality product. The way we make the soup is actually super simple. So we just take the parsnips, wash off any dirt that might be on them, coat them with a little bit of oil. You can use canola, olive oil, whatever, and salt. Then wrap them in foil or put them in a little pan that's covered and bake them in the oven until they get nice and soft in the center. And that concentrates the sugars and intensifies the flavor of the parsnip itself. And after they're roasted, they're kind of like brown on the outside, soft in the middle, and that makes them really easy to peel as well. So peel them after they're roasted. You can just slice down one side, take the peel off, and they're great like that. You could have like just a warm roasted parsnip dish. A little honey or salsa verde or something would be nice with that. Or like we do in the restaurant, we just puree them with a little water, actually, because for our meals, we keep it vegan, so everyone has the option of having the same dish. You could add a little cream. You could add something crunchy, some nuts or something. You have a nice, simple parsnip soup. It's absolutely delicious.
And if we were to do the parsnip soup with a little bit of the turnip, what proportion do you like?
Probably, it's about 3-to-1 parsnip to turnip. Like I said, the turnip's a little more bitter, and that kind of balances the super sweetness of the parsnip. If you don't have that, you could add a little, just onion would work as well, too, just to kind of balance that sweetness.
Mm-hmm. And to close today, you have a new parsnip dessert that's coming on the menu tonight.
Yeah, I mentioned it to you last night. Going on the menu tonight, we made a parsnip cake. Where we just replaced part of the oil in the recipe with a parsnip puree. Again, roasted, so it's super sweet. And this time of year, parsnips have natural sugars that make them great for dessert. Not traditional, obviously, but if you taste one roasted the way we talked about, it tastes like dessert. So we have parsnip cake with a coconut sorbet, a little brown butter powder, and some candied calamansi citrus.
Yum, that's going to be a fun take on your classic carrot cake.
Yeah, exactly. That was kind of the idea behind it, the twist.
No cream cheese frosting, though?
No, that would be a great idea.
John, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
John's brother, Mike Poyarkov, is now head chef at the much-loved Vinegar Hill House. And the Poyarkov brothers are doing a collaboration dinner this Thursday, February 27th, at Hillside Restaurant. Get your spots the old-fashioned way. Call the Pines at 718-596-6560. I'm your host, Leyte Su, and you're listening to Word of Mouth with Leyte Su on heritageradionetwork.org. Some social media info to start. As usual, hashtag WOMSHOW. WOMSHOW. For our in-studio guests, we have Chef Daniel Burns. He's at Chef D. Burns at Luxus NYC, LUKSUSNYC, at Taurus_NYC, TORST_NYC, and you, as always, at Leyte Su, LEITI, at Heritage_Radio. Tweet at us. And now for People We Like. Welcome, Daniel.
Welcome. Thank you.
So lovely having you on the show. I remember when I first invited you on, you ignored my invitation.
Yes, I didn't do that on purpose.
It's often what chefs do when they're opening up a place and they're sort of like...
A little bit overwhelmed.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, no. Congratulations on the recent New York Times mention.
Thank you.
How are things going at the restaurant?
Very well. We've stayed busy in the new year, which is always, I think, the concern. You know, January, February can be slower times, obviously. And yeah, it's going well these days.
I think what's surprising about your restaurant, it's, you know, Luxus, a tasting menu restaurant hidden in the back of a tourist, really, really intense beer bar. And I don't think people know that you can do the tasting and lunch and bar bites and the Sunday roast, and you could basically kind of live there.
Hopefully, yeah. We started out with like meat selection, cheese selection in the bar, and now we've expanded to a proper bar menu. So from noon every day, you can get lunch items and all kinds of hopefully tasty stuff.
And then there's that gorgeous the wall of beer taps.
Yes.
Like
21.
It's like what is that? There's something technically beautiful about it, right?
There is. Gabe from Beachwood Barbecue out in California built the special tap system for us. He calls it the flux capacitor. It's a tap system that is unique for each tap. We can pour beer at a specific pressure and gas combination. So basically each beer can pour ideally as it should for the style.
That's really nerdy.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about your food, because it comes from so many different influences, and you vehemently say that it is not New Nordic. But then you were included in a New York Times article about all the New Nordic action going on. Of course, the article has a sense of humor, and it's sort of like really giving it a critical look. Mm-hmm. And then, my goodness, I'm going to actually quote from this this article in the Globe and Mail, a major paper in Canada where you're from.
Uh-huh. The national newspaper.
National newspaper, thank you. Where the writer goes... He calls you a lanky Nova Scotian whose blonde mop of hair and pale red, white-speckled beard give him a Scandinavian demeanor, an effect heightened by his slate-colored, leather-strapped apron. So then people think you look Scandinavian, and they say your food is Scandinavian. I haven't seen any blood chips yet on the menu, though. And then the same writer then, well, you know, you had to give him credit. He calls your food actually... alien. He goes, the eating here is a bit like visiting another planet where a benevolent, more gustatorily advanced civilization grants you flavor combinations that send your taste buds into orbit. So where in the world is your food really from?
I approach food from seasonal aspect. So I think you need... Well, personally, yeah, I draw inspiration from what's available at the time. So, for sure, having spent 3 years at Noma in, you know, Scandinavia with all the influences that are there, a lot of the chefs over there are cooking in a similar fashion, I think. You know, very bright flavors, clean flavors. I think that wherever you work, you take influence directly, and also just indirectly, it becomes part of how you cook in general, whether you're thinking about it or not. So, 6 years in Europe, both England and Denmark, it surely has like shaped what I think about food.
Then, you know, people like to make fun of New Nordic cuisine and say that they don't necessarily, you know, crave. I have another... There's just so many great quotes lately, actually. I was just having a really fun time. Lots to read Lots to read. Okay, so, you know, Jeff Gordonier is like, hey, you know what? Like, I crave pasta or a burger more than I crave a charred beet in some, you know, lichen.
Yeah.
Lichen.
Yeah.
So, what is it from your childhood? What is it that you're cooking that you actually crave? You know, because what makes fine dining food really fun is when it's fine dining and then it's also comforting and just damn tasty.
Mm-hmm. I actually just think about making things delicious first. I don't know what another approach should really be. You know, food should be, of course, beautifully presented and all these things, but delicious, you know, sort of focus on 2-3 ingredients and flavors and make it, you know, clean, bright flavors. That's what I am focusing on.
What did your mom and dad do?
Both were teachers, high school, and so I grew up in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, a small place up there above Maine, and it was actually funny. By the time I reached high school, there's only 2 high schools in Dartmouth, so my dad was at one and my mother was at the other. So I didn't have much choice about I had to end up at high school with one of my parents. It was interesting. Yeah.
Wow.
So yeah, my mom taught home economics, and so we ate really well growing up, very nutritiously as well. And yeah, I guess I never really thought about cooking growing up. I did mathematics and philosophy in university, and then just sort of fell into cooking after that. So.
What happened when you went to eat at a friend's home for the first time?
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit shocking, but I just didn't realize that, you know, food could taste different than my mom would make, which was really awesome. Yeah.
And your dad, what did he teach?
He taught chemistry.
So you're like a mix of chemistry and home ec.
Possibly. Yeah, my oldest brother, I have 2 older brothers, and my oldest brother went into chemistry, which was good for my other 2 brothers. There was a big burden for one of us to do that. So I'm really glad that was not me that had to take that route.
Okay, so didn't think about cooking, math and philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I was one of those weird guys that did well in math in high school and really enjoyed it. I think there has to be some, like, innateness. You have to be just naturally good at a subject like math in order to do well, I think so.
Some people find their thing they're good at later on in life. Some people are not good at anything in school.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. But I don't know, with both my teachers and both my parents being teachers, I actually really loved going to school. All times, yeah.
Wow.
Including university.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So what was your, like, high school stereotype? Like, what were you?
Well, I played a lot of sports, you know, basketball and soccer in high school.
So you
and
were
then I played soccer at university, too. So.
Sporty nerd?
Ish.
Sporty nerd. Okay. So then you went to university, and you're still not cooking, and what prompted you to start cooking?
Well, I wanted to be math professor, and I realized that was not going to happen. I was not going to get my PhD in mathematics. Quite a difficult thing to do.
What was the class that really ended it for you?
Basically all of the third year. I went to Europe, traveled around, backpack, as a cliched thing to do, after my second year. And then when I got back in third year, it was, yeah, just a lot more difficult. I didn't want to, like, teach high school mathematics as my parents had done or whatever, so I just started thinking about what else to do.
Mm-hmm.
And became a barista for a short time, and then started cooking. Yeah,
worked at some restaurant in Canada.
Yeah, just a small cafe. I just asked if I could, like, he was opening a cafe, a new cafe, and I asked if I could like do the sandwiches and soup, just to test for myself whether I wanted to like wake up and cook as an action. And turn it, I did, and then I moved out west to Vancouver to start my apprenticeship. So,
what? How did you get in your mind that, hey, I want to go to Europe and I want to cook at the Fat Duck, and how did you get yourself there?
Girlfriend at the time moved back to Bristol, so I basically went to visit her, at which point I did three one-week stages, 1 week at the Fat Duck, 1 week at St. John, and 1 week at Le Manoir, Raymond Blanc's place. I just got very fortunate that I was offered a position at the Fat Duck. So there's basically someone leaving in 3 months' time. So I had a three-month window to run back to Canada and try to sort out my work permit. So that's what I did, yeah.
You were the first guy who got a foreign work permission to work at the Fat Duck?
Yeah. Which was, yeah, I mean, it was, there takes some effort. You know, you have to get the immigration lawyers and everything, but it is also a substantial amount of effort by the restaurant, so it was like it was super lucky that it all worked out in time, basically, because it was very time sensitive that the guy was leaving, I had to be there by date X, you know.
So to take it back to the food at your restaurant, it's very rare on my show that I really talk about the food at length, but it is difficult to explain, and we want to explain it so people want to know about it and want to come. So what are the bar bites like? We've got the
I think it's basically having worked in the UK, I think this sort of gastro pub stuff can be super super tasty. So there's a bit of English influence, I would say, and then also some Scandinavian for the bar menu side. So, like, yeah, kedgeree, as you said.
Kedgeree,
like Welsh rarebit. And then just some comforting stuff for the winter, like braised short ribs and stuff like that.
I think it's the only place in New York you can get kedgeree.
I think so. Also, maybe the flubala, the petit four that we do, which is a very Danish thing.
What is kedgeree?
Kedgeree is basically curried rice with smoked fish. So, curried rice, smoked whitefish, and then soft-boiled egg.
So it is a vestige of that smush-up of British colonial...
Yeah. It's a British dish that's, based on their love of Indian food, I guess.
I had it the other night, and of course, you know, I'm like rooting for more comfort food because I live like a five-minute walk away. So, delicious.
Thank you.
Even though I cannot pronounce it. And I'm a pretty good pronouncer.
Most people can.
We're going to go on a quick commercial break, but stay close, because when we get back, we'll talk about what it was like to cook at the Fat Duck and at NoMa and work with Rene Redzepi and so on and so forth. Medicine still didn't need the fear of God, but all he was a man enough going down.
You're listening to Man of Sin by Brothers NYC on heritageradionetwork.org.
Interested in emerging design? Check out Of A Kind, a site that sells the pieces and tells the stories of up-and-coming makers. The site has featured over 200 designers and offers limited edition pieces you can't find anywhere else, along with the studio tours, travel guides, even recipes from the designers. To find out more, head to ofakind.com and sign up for the site's newsletter.
said, I am the wrath of God. If you fuck with my kid, I'm going down.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue. I'm your host, Lady, and I'm here in the studio with Chef Daniel Burns, chef owner of Luxus at Torst. Daniel?
Yes.
You are really nutty about cutting the blue tape and about cleanliness in the kitchen, like Sweeney Todd level nutty. I don't know. It's just, you got like a crazy look in your eye when you talked about cleanliness. Like, this is just a fun thing about cooking at a high level that I want to explore. Where does that come from?
Where does it come from? I think
why is it important?
Well, I mean, yeah, obviously cleanliness in the kitchen is, it's either clean or it's not. if it's not clean, there's a certain sense of laziness that you didn't clean it in sort of my mind, you know. Yeah, it's obviously super important from a hygiene standpoint and all that. But I think having done the amount of work in the pastry that I have, pastry sections that I've done, is that sort of necessitates a bit of a cleaner work environment. And then to apply that back to the savory kitchen is sort of just how my kitchen functions now.
So, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, so make it clean and then everything's good.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your mentors. What have been some of the biggest influences in your cooking?
Well, for sure, you know, when I started at the Fat Duck, I did not have loads of experience. I was pretty much straight after completing my apprenticeship, so about 4.5 years of cooking, and then I went to Europe. So Hessen, obviously incredible mentor. It was 2004, so he was still there for half the services a week, calling the checks and stuff. So it was also before any
stuff. And why is that?
What's that?
Why is that?
Why is what?
What do you mean by that?
Well, he was physically in the kitchen plating and stuff, not off doing the, you know, TV shows and everything at that point still. And it was before they bought the Heinz Head, the pub right down the street.
Okay.
So there was no test kitchen and everything. So we actually didn't have any stagiaires, which now they probably have 20 or 25 a month. So.
And this was pre the 3 stars?
Just after the 3 stars.
Just after.
And right before they got number one in the top 50. So
wow.
It was a very interesting time. And yeah, to see sort of it grow to this bigger thing with stagiaires and all this stuff.
What did you learn from Heston?
Well, it was during the time when he figured out about the freeze clarification for stocks, where make a stock, freeze it, and then drip it in the walk-in through cheesecloth, which was very, very interesting and highly, you know, a lot of people use that technique nowadays. So there's, you know, for a consomme, you would normally add egg whites, and then there's inevitably some egg flavor in the stock when you do that process. So he basically, you know, it's almost a distillation of flavor by simply freezing, which was super cool.
Mm-hmm.
And so such a sort of big discovery, a lot of chefs would just hide it and take it for themselves, like a, you know, like a Gollum thing, you know. And but he is all about sharing ideas, and that's a big thing that I learned from. I think it's more often chefs in Europe might be apt to do so, but so the next week after this massive discovery, he used to write a column for The Guardian, and he shared it with everyone in the column, which was like just amazing to see someone just do that. And so then housewife could do this crazy amazing technique. So,
mm-hmm.
Hessen, obviously a big mentor, and of course more I worked with Jockey James Petrie, the pastry chef, who he was there for I guess almost 12 years, He moved to the head of the test kitchen afterwards, after I left. And, yeah, incredible chef and super talented in a lot of ways.
And then you went to Noma and headed up pastry for 3 years?
3 years, yeah. 2006 I went there.
What is it like to work with Renee?
Incredibly inspiring. and also... in sort of the working relationship that Renee and I had was he would come to me with a dish idea, and then I would have the freedom to experiment with those flavors. So it was a very symbiotic way to come about a dish.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they were my desserts in any way, but to be able to have the freedom to like make the recipes and test it out and, mm-hmm. and taste it together was really, really just a really amazing process. Yeah,
and to take ownership.
I led the pastry section the whole time I was there, and had a lot of responsibility. And for the guests that passed through,
to be pastry at Noma, you're like, well, you just had all this amazing stuff, and now you're full-ish. And so I'm just going to, the pastry chef always has it tough.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the big part about it is, I think in the modern kitchen, the sweet things have to flow directly from the afterwards of the savory. You know, they can't be overly sweet in my mind.
Definitely. What you've worked with so many greats, is there something that you think that differentiates the armies of chefs and cooks with the truly great chef cooks?
I think, especially having seen how Noma, how the dishes gets created at Noma, I think the most important one of the most important things is the dish. When conceiving a dish, you have to have a very strong idea what you want to have people taste. So whether it's like a childhood memory experience or flavors that tell a story, basically. When you can make and create dishes like that, then people really get it, and so I think both Hessen and Renee and loads of other great chefs, I think that's a common thread, that they're just really good at.
So we'll bring you back then to a dish on your menu right now at the tasting menu at Luxus, which is the chrysanthemum and rutabaga and shaved smoked egg.
Yeah.
Wait, smushed through a sieve, smoked egg,
rice,
soupy,
yeah,
thing.
Rice.
Rice?
Riced smoked
rice,
egg.
Rice, yes.
Yeah.
That's the right term for it. Sure. Okay. How did you conceive of this dish? It's...
I actually, to be honest, was in Chinatown and I
saw... Let's describe it a little more first.
Okay. It's like a broth of... pork and chrysanthemum,
mm-hmm.
with roasted rutabaga puree, smoked egg whites. That's basically it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in Chinatown and just saw the chrysanthemum, the dried ones, and it was like, looks very interesting. I should mess around with that. And then the pork, it's basically minced pork that has a blend of bacon in it. So that sounded interesting as well. So it made sort of an Asian flavored pork mince. Roasted it and then
put egg drop soup.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess so. And then I put it with fennel and chrysanthemum Chinese cinnamon broth.
So what was the story you were telling there?
What's that?
What's the story that you were telling there?
Not sure. Make a delicious broth on that one. I made a really good egg roll mix that I want people to try.
Right, all the fake Chinese food that you've eaten,
yeah.
That still tastes good, even though it's very much not good.
Yeah. So, and then the smoked egg whites. I'm not sure where that came from, but it made sense.
How did you meet David Chang?
We met The last week I was at NoMA was the first Cook It Raw dinner. Mm. So
nice.
Dia Chang was part of that, and you know, we got chatting, and I mentioned that I was gonna go to Vancouver, and you know, I didn't really have a plan. I thought I would try to do a restaurant back in Canada, turns out that I didn't really want to do that that much. And then, so yeah, we basically just stayed in contact after the Cook It Raw dinner, organized for my work permit to come down to the States to work, and I got to open the test kitchen for Mofugu. Yeah.
He's a big fan of Luxus.
He's come to eat once already, which is awesome.
That's wonderful.
Yes.
It must be so lovely cooking for former bosses and collaborators.
It is. It is. It's always special when chefs come and check it out.
And how did you meet your partners in Luxus and Taurus? You have some pretty phenomenal beer talent.
Beer talent, yeah. Yepe, who curates the beer program, is a gypsy brewer, and his brand is called Evil Twin Brewing. His twin brother, Mikkel, has a Mikkeller, and he's back in Denmark. So basically, Yeppe wanted to expand his brand, and so did that by moving to Brooklyn, and is over here working with very closely with Westbrook Brewing in Charleston, and also with Two Roads, which is in just upstate in Connecticut. So those two breweries is where he does like 95% of his production these days. Obviously amazing to work with such, you know, his beer knowledge is crazy.
And, was it scary to open in Greenpoint?
Well, that's where I've lived for the 4 years I've been in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I love the neighborhood. It made a lot of sense. I'm sure, had I thought about it a bit more, maybe it is a bit scary. but I think, you know, it's changing a lot, Greenpoint, and we're in a good spot at the top of the park, top of McCarran Park, like close to the Nassau G, but also just 10-minute walk from the Bedford L train. So it's, I think still Greenpoint is really nowhere in people's minds, but it's actually really accessible from
really
a
accessible.
Lot of places. Yeah.
I mean, from Manhattan, like 30 minutes.
Yeah. If you're a 10-minute walk from the Bedford L, it's pretty accessible too, from pretty much anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. You have a fairly self-selected audience of diners at Luxus, because you don't just, like, I mean, unless you live in Greenpoint, you don't just happen to be in Greenpoint.
Right.
Well, it's been, like, the coolest compliment, you know? You're doing, like, very spare and idiosyncratic food that you hope that is delicious. Like, wow, what's the feedback?
The feedback? I think some people, I think a good amount of people think it's a unique experience, because, as you say, it's in the back of a beer bar. It's a small, tiny, pretty intimate room, and then there's absolutely no choice. I try not to put the menu out there too much. We don't have it on the website, and so it's like it's sort of this experience that is, for lack of a better word, just completely curated. We completely curate the whole experience.
So one compliment from one diner that sticks out in your mind.
I don't know exact compliment, but like, you know, a lot of people, as I say, think it's unique and different. For I'm basically trying to go for a more European approach to the setup of the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And the format for the menu starts with snacks and then moves into the main servings, which is very much how you eat in Scandinavia.
It's quite snack heavy, but it's not too amuse-bouche.
Yeah.
And douchey.
Yeah, amuse-bouche, yeah, I think it's why they rhyme, yeah. It's like, you know, eat with your hands. You start out by eating with your hands,
mm-hmm.
and it's like relaxing and hopefully just like whets your appetite for what's to come.
My last question for you, is it still your dream job? If you hadn't gone into cooking, is it still your dream job to be a math professor?
I think it would have been amazing. Yeah, I think that would have been super fun.
All right, give me one more. Another dream job.
One more?
Yeah.
professional football player.
Oh, okay. Right. Oh, let's spiel your football.
Oh, yeah, football. It's my first year at NOMA. I was asked Renee, like, what? Basically, all the chefs are the same age, 30s, run these amazing restaurants. And I was like, when do you guys ever hang out? And he's like, well, we hang out if it's in the kitchen together. And I'm like, okay, I'll be the odd Canadian and start up a football tournament for all the restaurants there. So it's a five-a-side football tournament, DB Invitational, football, whatever you want to call it. And it'll be the
DB? What does DB mean?
My initials.
Are you serious? Did you really call it that?
What's that?
Did you really call it the DB Invitational?
The first... I did.
That's funny.
It's because it's... If you're invited, then you can play. So it's the seventh year this year, and it's a charity event for Action Against Hunger. And, so I'm going to go back to Copenhagen in June and do that again.
So you've gone back every year, seven years.
Yeah, the sixth one did not happen because I was opening a restaurant. Yeah. So that's super fun. And then it's like a great way to reconnect with all friends back in Denmark.
And you go on your birthday, which is just a great excuse to go
and eat around.
Do something fun for your birthday.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining me, Daniel.
Thanks, Lacey.
We have just a little bit of time left. We're going to wind it down with Colin Tuska, wine director at Prospect Restaurant in Fort Greene.
Wine down.
I'm at Prospect BK with beverage director Colin Tuska.
That is me.
Yay.
That is me indeed.
Hi.
Welcome.
This is a beautiful restaurant.
Yeah, it's a cool little restaurant on Fulton Street in Fort Greene. We're situated pretty close to Bannon Barclay.
Colin, you're having a wine dinner coming up. Can you tell me more about it?
Yeah, of course. My next wine dinner is going to be on the 27th of February. That is a Thursday evening. I'm very, very excited about this one specifically. It's my first one that I'm actually doing with a wine producer. The wine producer is from Friuli. It's a family-owned estate. Been around since the 1970s. They actually helped prevent certain varietals or grapes from going extinct. They planted their vineyards very closely situated to the woods. Funny little thing, a side story about the producer is there was one point where they thought they were going to lose a bunch of crop. There was actually this one spider that was kind of overtaking their vineyards, and they were freaking out, thinking that their vineyards would be destroyed by the spider. And by the circle of life, as I would call it, another spider came in and destroyed all those, and obviously helped them keep their product, importantly, intact, and they're still producing wines now.
Oh my gosh. So these guys have done a lot to prevent certain grape varieties from going extinct.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why do I, as a... I'm not a casual wine drinker, I'm an avid one, but why do I, as a wine drinker, just a wine drinker who loves wine but doesn't, you know, why do I care?
Well, I mean, one thing that's very important about this region is there was a popularity and a trend of these heirloom varietals being ripped out and replaced by Merlot and Cabernet.
Right.
Not saying that those are inferior grapes, but those were not classic grapes of that region.
And it's because those grapes have a worldwide market, and they sell for big bucks. And
people know them, and it's easy to enjoy them. And like, with these varietals that they do, like, they have a broad spectrum. They do white, they do a few different reds, and they do a sweet wine as well. And Scovizzino, the Italians have given this term of endearment for the grape, and they call the grape little gunshot. And when the grape's actually, I believe, stemmed, or when it's in the fermentation process, one of the two, and I probably should know this, the grape explodes, and that's why they call it the gunshot, because it pops.
Again, why do we care? Like, why do we care about grapes that are esoteric, that nobody knows about, that are almost going extinct?
Well, other than them just almost going extinct, one thing I find extremely important is providing people a beverage that tastes good. And if the wine didn't taste good and it's just this heirloom varietal, who cares?
Yeah.
Just like any other thing. It's like, is that Coke cool today, or is that Coke cool tomorrow? Or is that super cool thing that was passed down from your great-grandmother and it means something to you and means something to a historical standpoint of the place and time? and it takes you maybe in a time machine.
So would I be, you know, worse off if I just drink a bunch of grapes that everyone knew about and that were widely available? I mean, like, what am I...
I don't think you're worse off if you consume stuff that is known and readily available. I think what happens if you consume things that are lesser known, it broadens your horizons. It expands your palate. You have something that you can come to a party with, and you bring a bottle of wine to a friend's house, or you go to a restaurant.
Tell me more about your wine dinner program. How often do you do these?
The wine dinner program, basically, it started out, I wanted to do these monthly. And basically each dinner be a focus on a different place, different region of the world. One thing for myself when I continue to taste wines is I like to expose myself to something that I'm going to learn from and the guests are going to learn from.
Colin has been known to swoop out with surprise wines that are just extra credit on top of what's listed on the menu, so...
Which will be happening the evening that dinner.
Come out, and you might be pleasantly surprised that was totally a spoiler.
Yeah, a little bit, that's fine. It's okay, I mean...
Only for listening
some to... Some people like to look at their present before they receive it.
Word of mouth. You can poke a little hole in your box.
Yeah, exactly. Thirdly, exposing people to something that they didn't have before. I mean, when you walk on the street and you say, walk up to a person in a wine store and say, Scopatino, they're probably going to look at you like, what the heck happened to you? What the heck is that? And I get to provide this dinner as my vessel or stage to expose people to this producer's wines and that grape.
And just throw a party with the producer.
Throw a little party with the producer and hang out.
Oh, yay.
A little party never hurt anybody.
Thank you so much, Colin.
Thank you so much.
I like esoteric grapes. I do. That was just me playing devil's advocate and giving Colin a really hard time. Because we want a more colorful world. A crayon box of 100 crayons is better than a box with just 10 colors. Say hi to Colin at his wine dinners and stay in touch on Twitter at ProspectBK. And if you're not on there, the tried and true way, 718-596-6826. For Prospect Restaurant. This is Word of Mouth with Leti Su on Heritage Radio Network. Next week, we'll have Master Sommelier Carlton McCoy, wine director of the famed Little Nell restaurant in Aspen, Colorado. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.